We are fortunate today to actually have three guests joining us for the session. Our first speaker is Kevin Reel. Kevin may be a familiar face to some of you who've come to a past AGM session. He was here and he presented to us on ethics previously. He's also the voice on the audio clips in COTBC's ethics learning module. So if you've had a chance to listen to that, you might recognize the voice. Kevin studied occupational therapy a long time ago, somewhat far away, according to his description, in Toronto. He then worked, lived, and studied in the UK for 16 years, where he got his MSc in medical ethics. He returned to Toronto 8 years ago to do a fellowship in clinical and organizational ethics at the Joint Centre for Bioethics. He is currently the ethicist at the Toronto Central Community Care Access Centre, having done the same role at the Centre for Addiction and Mental Health, Southlake Regional Health Centre, and Mackenzie Health. He is a member of the Joint Centre for Bioethics at the University of Toronto and on their MAID Implementation Task Force. He is also an assistant professor with the Department of Occupational Science and Occupational Therapy and a faculty member of the Global Institute for Psychosocial, Palliative, and End-of-Life Care. While he clearly has a passion for quality end-of-life care, he is also very interested in sex. The two can intersect, apparently. And is a member of the Sexual Health and Disability Alliance International. In his spare time, he likes to play with power tools and kitchen appliances, usually to separate ends. So welcome. Also with us today is Dr. Heidi Otter. Dr. Otter joined the College of Physicians and Surgeons of BC as a deputy registrar in May 2004 and was responsible for many portfolios including ethics, quality assurance, and peer review, and the prescription review of and methadone programs. In 2008, she was appointed to the position of Registrar and CEO, where she is accountable for ensuring compliance with statutory obligations, implementing and monitoring the policies and strategic directions set forth by the board, and managing the daily operations and administration. In 2009, she transitioned the college to the Health Professions Act. Dr. Otter has been recognized for her accomplishments as a medical leader provincially and nationally. In addition to past leadership positions on the board of the BC Medical Association, which is now Doctors of BC, and the Canadian Medical Protective Association Council, she currently sits as a member of the Board of Directors of the Federation of Medical Regulatory Authorities of Canada, is a member of the Executive Board of the Medical Council of Canada, and a member of the Executive Committee of the BC Health Regulator Society. For 18 years, prior to joining the college, Dr. Otter worked as a family physician in Coquitlam, BC. She obtained her medical degree from UBC in 1985. Welcome, Dr. Otter. And finally, but certainly not least, Cynthia Johansson. Cynthia is the Registrar and CEO of the College of Registered Nurses of British Columbia. Cynthia joined the college in 2006 as the Director of Registration, Inquiry, and Discipline. She became the Registrar or CEO in April of 2012. And previous to this, Cynthia served as the Registrar and CEO of the College of Dental Hygienists in BC. Cynthia has a BA in Political Science, an MA in Leadership Studies, and an MSc in Information Management. She's the chair of the BC Health Regulators, a society made up of health profession regulatory colleges in British Columbia. She's also the president of the Canadian Council of Registered Nurses, of Registered Nurse Regulators, and an ex-officio member of the NCLEXRN Exam Committee. I don't know if that's the right way to say that. NCLEX. Much better. Cynthia represents CRNBC on the International Nurse Regulators Collaborative, a group of nursing regulators that includes the USA, UK, Australia, New Zealand, Singapore, and Ireland. Cynthia has extensive experience in investigating and reporting on issues of public safety and access to care, and working with government, the public, and stakeholders on improving professional practice standards and health profession regulation. Prior to joining the health profession regulatory industry in 2006, Cynthia served as the chief of staff to the Minister of Health Planning in BC and had worked in the Premier's office. So without further ado, I will hand the mic over to Kevin, who will start the session today. Later on, there will be an opportunity to ask the panel questions that you may have about the topic, which I'm sure will emerge as we're going through. I'll ask you to hold those questions until the panel because we have a very short time. So if we can hold those and you'll be invited for them, make sure you write them down because we don't want to lose those good thoughts. Given the session is being recorded, if you do need to ask a question at that time, I'll just ask that you actually speak into the mic, and I'll remind you about this so that we can make sure your good question is recorded. So without much further ado, over to Kevin. Thank you all very much, and welcome today.
Thank you, Andrea. So apologies, because we're going to go through this fairly quickly, but I will make myself endlessly available all afternoon, because I'm here till tomorrow morning. I fly back at 7 a.m., and so I don't have anything planned this afternoon, so we can go have a drink of anything, or two or three. And secondly, I was really responsible for making the board meeting, I think, go well over time yesterday, so I'm sorry to you, Flots, but you had great comments and questions. So we'll hold the questions till the panel open forum at the end. And I'll first say that, and I think I can speak for everybody, that this, without a doubt, is a topic that cuts to the core of everybody's values, which means that it touches very deep into the heart of everybody's own self-identity. And I hope I don't say anything or convey anything that causes any affront and gives me the impression of being insensitive. So catch me out if I do. Tell me afterwards. Write a little note about what I said and pass it to me and explain it to me. I'm hoping that that won't happen, and I'm hoping that we will have a useful session. So effectively, we're here. You know why we're here. We're here to look at this new dimension of healthcare practice in Canada, assisted dying, and to look at it, I always like to look at it in the context of high-quality end-of-life care. Some people want to hive it off for very good reasons of their own, but I like to see it all as part and parcel. And of course, we're looking at it in the context of occupational therapy practice and what OTs might be doing or not doing or could be doing around high-quality end-of-life care where MAID is or is not part of it all. So we'll look at some ethics again. I'm an ethicist. We'll look at the federal and the provincial legislation around it. That's why I'm so happy to have my esteemed colleagues here to fill in on the provincial bit, which I don't know quite as much about at all, in the BC context anyways. And then we'll look at some of the potential roles for occupational therapists in end-of-life care and MAID in particular. Many of you know that we conducted a survey a couple years ago across Canada of OTs and their views on this issue and what they might offer or might not offer. And then a very nice group of you responded to the invite to be part of a reflective exercise a couple weeks ago. And so I've got a few of the little bits and pieces that garnered from that. In both cases, I didn't necessarily expect to find any kind of incredibly indicative data. It was just a sort of litmus test, a kind of finger in the wind about where is occupational therapy and where are occupational therapists at on this. And it was also a chance, many people said in their responses, to actually reflect on the issue in a very different way than just having a conversation while the news was on. So we'll also look very much at the interprofessional roles, because as we all know, medical and nurse practitioners are critical in this. But many people will tell you who have gone through any kind of protracted end-of-life scenario with their loved ones that a lot of other health professionals are absolutely essential to that being as good as it could be, given what it is. And also look at what you offered as suggestions for potential college resources to be offered here. So first of all, a little review from 3 years ago. Ethics, that big word, is really about just determining good and bad, right and wrong. And a colleague of mine loves to, and it's really quite useful, you think about the things you could do that are defensible legally and ethically, and then out of that you've got to pick out the one that you should do or you should try first. And it sounds really simple as that. It ain't anywhere near as simple as that. It's a little more like this. I think this should be a prize to anybody who can really say in 10 words or less what that sign means. So, and then what we talked about last time around was the idea that ethics happens to us, both in personal life and in practice. And I've got three words that sum it up quite distinctly. You get a yuck. And that's this gut feeling that's something wrong. And then you start thinking about the muck that is behind that yuck. And it's typically things to do with, is this a good example? Is this legal? Is this moral? Can I defend this? What will this look like if it's on the front page of the Globe and Mail? all those kinds of things. Who might be upset if I do this, or who might be upset if I do that? What's the outcome going to be in the end? What's the difference in the outcomes? One can only imagine that people like Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump are endlessly trying not to think about the muck because they've mired themselves in it rather well. And then what you aim for when you want to be an ethical practitioner or just another good human being is what I picked a word that rhymes, okay, it's pluck. And pluck is an old word for a sense of fortitude or a sense of certainty about what you should do and why you should do it. The thing about pluck is, it's where you get to when you've sifted through a lot of the muck, but it won't necessarily take away the yuck. It'll help keep the yuck in check and help you understand why you feel yucky about something. Imagine having to discipline your kid or your partner or, you know, tell a very good friend something as onerous as their partner's having an affair or their haircut isn't quite what they think it is in terms of attractiveness. There's still some yuck there, but if you think through the muck, you might decide that you're going to say or not say either of those issues. We typically work through the muck by thinking about these things we call values and principles. And then in practice, we have our value set, our personal one and then our professional one. And with that, we expect that they will make the world a better place. And we do that by applying them through principles that we then bring to the skill sets that we offer to our clients every day. So that's how they offer this kind of fundamental foundation to good practice in the end. You're working typically from a value set, and when you're at the front end and trying to apply your skills, and it's really confusing about whether this is feeling good or not, it's touching right back to those values, which is why, in the case of assisted dying, it feels like what we have to do at the skills end, the actual action end, might not entirely rest at ease with the principles and the values that are informing our life and our practice. So when we asked OTs across Canada what values they identified as principal in OT practice, we took a bunch of values kind of words out of professional documents and gave them a list. And then we were a little bit cruel. I had a yuck factor about this. We said, just pick three. So when we forced the choice, the one that came out on top was client-centered practice by far. And I have to say, I did breathe a sigh of relief because I thought that's what should come out on top. And then the other one was respect, which is great, meaning, which is great. And then the other ones were very clearly identified as worthy by many people. But it's this interesting thing about a field that feels itself primarily driven by a value of client-centered practice. What kind of yuck is that setting us up for when a client might end up asking us to do something or be involved in something as part of a team providing care that just doesn't feel like it feels good to us, but this is precisely what a very reflective and well-informed, capable client is saying they feel is best for them. So it's really going to be difficult in many cases to feel really wonderful about client-centered practice when that client is asking for something that just feels kind of profoundly yucky, as it does to many people. The other thing is that just always reminding ourselves that this is part of a long menu of what can happen when somebody is facing an end-of-life care situation. And in practice, what happens is people may actually request this, go through formal requests and formal preparation for it, and ultimately decide to hold off on it. And many people actually don't even take advantage of it in the end. But what they want is this option, that if they need to do this, they can do this. And the stats are something like in Oregon, where what happens is you get a prescription and you then get a medication that you then take on your own. A lot more people get the prescription than ever actually have the prescription dispensed. It's about a third that don't actually use it in the end. And it's just about having that option in case I can't actually make it. So there is classic palliative care, managing physical and psychoexistential pain, typically defined as a point at which where we're not seeking a curative treatment necessarily. That said, some people who are still in curative treatment may need a palliative pain consult because the pain is so great that it's the palliative care physicians who know best about how far they can go with these things. There's palliative sedation, which is this idea that if we can't actually control your pain, what we could do, if you wish, is put you in a pretty deep sleep until your body finally dies and you don't have to actually feel that pain. Not something that everybody would want to do, but something that some people do regularly. And then there's this other thing that is part of end-of-life care and has been for years as well, which is withdrawing life-sustaining treatments, including things like artificial nutrition and hydration. So if I have ended up in a position where I'm dependent on one of these things, without ever asking for assisted dying, I can actually just ask to have that withheld. That's within my rights. And then I can also ask for something to be withdrawn. So if it's been started, I can say stop. It gets really complex because then you get into things like implantable cardioverter defibrillators, which are inside there. And you can easily deprogram the defibrillator, but it still is a pacer. And I found out a lot of that working with the nurse practitioners when one of my last jobs. And then there's this thing about voluntary stopping eating and drinking, which is what a lot of people do. And it's something that's often happening without us really knowing because they don't discuss it. And it's part of a realm of events that is poorly tracked called passive suicide, where people don't discuss their wishes. They just do it this way. We now have a national framework for integrated palliative care, which will hopefully help make things a little bit better. It came out just before MAID was in the process of being legalized. So there's an interesting relationship between palliative care and assisted dying that is a particular Canadian one, very different than the one that evolved in places like Belgium and the Netherlands, where palliative care physicians were doing this and wanted it legalized. Here, it's kind of the opposite way around. So we'll see what happens with this over time. For ethics in OT, we have a lot of decision-making tools. So the College of OT, of course, has its code of ethics. CAOT has its framework for ethics. And then, as sometimes happens with specific issues, you take a particular deep dive in ethics. So we've done this around things like pandemic planning and said, well, which principles are particularly important here? And there's been much written about that. More recently, we've done it around the critical shortage of intravenous medications, which has caused a lot of problems and a lot of really anxiety-provoking moments where we don't have enough IV meds to go around. So how do you make those determinations? And also, as of late, medical cannabis and how you actually implement a medical cannabis policy at a place like the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, where I used to work. So what we did at the Joint Center for Bioethics was we did a specific discussion paper around assisted dying and implementing it in Canada, and we looked at which ethics principles were the most relevant ones. And the trouble with doing that is that we did it in a vacuum, so the law hadn't been changed yet. We knew a lot of things that we'd read and done, so we wrote as best we could at the time. We'd probably edit it now if we rewrote it. But what we ended up with was a list of principles. And so one list of principles here is the College of OT's list. The other list was from our discussion paper. Anybody recognize which one is which? It's not a test. It's not a test. Bravo. One on the left is the college. So why did we come up with different principles? Oh, good Lord. Well, the fact is, when you know the principles enough, you can actually figure out which ones are speaking to the same thing. So all the highlighted ones here are covered in the other set, which is most of them. And then what's interesting is, when we asked you, you came up with the underlined ones as the ones that were most relevant. So you've got most of them in both sets. And then the purple ones were the ones that came out on top as most important ones to you, in your personal ethics at least. So you're really big on autonomy, which is basically client-centered practice, and fairness, which is also wonderful to hear. You also added in a few others like client-centered practice itself and integrity. And then if you map them, they all map rather well onto each other. So we're not speaking to different purposes, we're just using different points of departure when we pick one word over the other. And then some will prevail, like client-centered practice. So that's where we're at now. Beyond the ethical parameters here, legally, we've got things that are legal and not legal around when people have their lives ended. So there's this thing that's been called physician-assisted suicide, which I've put in quotes and italics because I don't like the word in this context. And we found out since Bill C-14 that in Canada, it's both medical and nurse practitioner assisted. There's something called voluntary active euthanasia, something called voluntary passive euthanasia, and there's something else that is not legal called involuntary euthanasia, which happens against somebody's will. It's unethical, so it's just entirely off the table. The difficulty is this word euthanasia keeps getting muddled up in people's minds and people think all these things. But this one is just not there. Anybody able to tell me what euthanasia actually means, its root words? It doesn't actually mean dark horrors of the Holocaust, which is what first comes to mind because that was the most extraordinary thing to have happened probably so far to humanity. Strangely, despite its association with the Nazi period, it means good death. It's a laudable end that comes out of Greece and even Hippocrates in a different way. You want to keep people comfortable and give them as good a death as possible, which might work out to the least worst death in many cases. So euthanasia is actually seeking to do good at the time of death. So with voluntary passive euthanasia, this is actually legal and ethical and has been in practice for many years. And this is about withdrawing and withholding things. So you might not start antibiotics for somebody who develops a pneumonia. You might withdraw breathing support for somebody who's dependent on a breather. They may capably request this, as has happened plenty of times with me in my ethics practice. They may not be capable of requesting it, but their substitute decision maker may say this is what they would want if they could stand here, look at themselves, and make this decision. So this has been happening in ICUs, palliative care units, and various other places for years, and it's considered what you have to do when you have a capable request to do this, or a substitute decisions maker's request that's deemed legitimate within the law. The other ones that are here in the middle, they're now decriminalized. So C-14, that bill that changed things, isn't itself a law. It changed the criminal code. And the criminal code now has a carve-out that says, despite the fact that murder is wrong and a criminal offense, and despite the fact that assisting somebody to kill themselves is a criminal offense, it doesn't apply here. There's an exemption, and that exemption is all around made. So the first one is where somebody just gets assistance through the means of a prescription, and then the pharmacist would dispense it. And then at that point, the person can take it on their own at their will according to their plan. From what I hear, it's not the favorite approach among most of the professionals I work with because they much prefer to make sure that it happens really, really well, and they'd rather be there so that nothing goes wrong. The other one is when you're involved in a more hands-on way and you actually administer the medication, usually by IV, and that in most cases typically involves a nurse who sets up the IV and then the physician or nurse practitioner will come and actually administer the meds. So there's a dividing line between this middle one and the one on the far left, which tells you what's been legal and not legal until now. It tells you what people say is the difference between what's been moral and what they might say is still immoral, depending on what their take on assisted dying is. But for me, what that line has always shown is effectively where you end up, what I call the perverse lottery of end of life. If you were on the left of that line, you were one of the lucky, unlucky folks who is facing a situation where you may think that you want to die sooner than you would do otherwise, if you were kept alive. But you have every right to say, stop this or don't do that, because there's something that's needed to keep you alive. If you're in the middle there, on the right-hand side of that line, you've not had that bit of weird luck in this perverse lottery because you've actually needed somebody to do something to bring it about. And what people have done is then they've stopped eating or drinking and they've had a longer, slower process of death. The gentleman in Quebec who actually stopped eating and drinking for 2 weeks so that he would be so ill that he would actually qualify for assistance in dying because he wouldn't get it otherwise. So there's very, very strange stories and experiences that can come out of this. And hopefully what's happened now with this breaking of the line between the two legally is that it's made things a little bit fairer. And what it's also done is it's only ever done it as an option for those who want it. So nowhere in here is anybody expected to be doing this. And the legislation specifically says that there should be no undue influence on somebody, no coercion to do this. And we have to always look out for that. So this is the Carter carve-out. And what happens is that's the federal criminal code that's been changed to offer this carve out. There's now an exemption from prosecution for people who are involved in assisting a death in this very active way, if it falls in line with what is described as made. The other thing that gets a little bit confusing in this circumstance is the difference between treatment and other care. So you may all know of this woman named Margot Bentley, who's in a long-term care home. She was the subject of a very fine documentary on the Sunday edition called In the Presence of a Spoon, who has a very involved advance directive saying that she wouldn't want any kind of life-sustaining treatment. She's in advanced dementia. The trouble is that she still responds by opening her mouth when a spoon of food is presented to her cheek or her lips. And the long-term care home says that they can't deny the necessities of life, and it's not medical treatment. It's just care. So it gets really murky, which is why the whole issue of advanced directives around MAID is that much more complex and isn't available at the moment and may become or may not become available in a few years' time. So as we said, MAID is these two things. The first is the active one, where medical or nurse practitioner is actually administering. And the second is the prescribing of a medication that can then be sought and sorted. There's various safeguards in place in the criminal code now, which includes safeguards. The purple ones are for the practitioners, which means they've got an exemption. And then there are other safeguards that are aimed at protecting the people who might be making requests. Probably know about most of them. Written request, it has to be witnessed by two people, a 10-day reflection period, two independent assessors, making sure that this person's eligible, and specific requirements around the independence of the witnesses and the practitioners that are confirming eligibility. And then there's the basic eligibility criteria around you have to be an adult, you have to be capable, you have to have a grievous and irremediable condition. More on that in a moment. It has to be voluntary. It has to be done in a position of informed consent about all of your options. And you have to be somebody who's eligible for government-funded healthcare in Canada, which means that we won't be allowed to offer this to somebody who comes to Canada looking for it, like so many Canadians that have gone to Switzerland looking for it there. So we're not opening up that door at the moment. And then grievous and irremediable was the one that occupied a lot of debate. And this is what it ended up being defined as, which is in some ways a little bit like that road sign about parking. So it's serious and incurable. You are in an advanced state of irreversible decline in capability. You have enduring physical or psychological suffering that's intolerable to you. And then the last one that was much debated was natural death has become reasonably foreseeable, though we don't need a prognosis and we don't need a kind of time estimate. So there's a lot of like very wishy-washy words in there. And interestingly, a big think tank I respect in the UK called the Nuffield Council on Bioethics did a big project about what is natural in the minds of people. And they found out that there's no real consensus at all and vast variation on what is natural. And one of their primary recommendations after this long and very thorough project was don't ever use this word in law and public policy. But here we got it. So now we have to work with it. And the one thing I can kind of say is that I'm so glad because it's other people, other practitioners, the poor medical and nurse practitioners who are going to have to deal with these criteria and make sure that they're meeting them despite any kind of little worries that somebody could challenge it. And again, trying to be client-centered, one of the biggest concerns in a lot of people's practice is litigation. And if you feel like you could be seen to be going against this, then it's a problem. So what we'll do is pass it over now to my colleagues to go on a little bit more about how it works in the provincial regulated context here and within their professions.
Thank you very much, Kevin. So you've just heard that the eligibility criteria around serious and incurable, an advanced state, enduring physical or psychological suffering, and that death has become reasonably foreseeable. And people like to say, well, is that 2 weeks, 2 months, 6 months, 2 years? And I can't add any further clarity to this, I'm sorry, except to go to the website And the ministry said this is not death on demand. It's balancing for those for whom death is clearly in their crosshairs, the option of choosing a peaceful death over a death that is likely to cause tremendous suffering. And that was decided in the Carter case to be a charter right. And yes, it's now founded in amendments to the criminal code. So it's where we're at. And speaking as a regulator, I just would like to start with a disclaimer that this will be the most profound social policy change that I will experience in my lifetime as a physician. It's controversial. It is, people are deeply divided about this. People have very strong opinions. But as a regulator, our interest is always public interest. And we have, as a regulator, a responsibility to set ethical and professional standards. So it's not about being for or against medical assistance in dying. It's about what is the public interest when people have a lawful right to access a service. And that's where I start from. And I also just want to apologize to those people who are in the palliative care world. We understand that the concept of medical assistance in dying is a phrase that many of the palliative care community believe they own, and they don't like the word medical assistance in dying. They believe it should be hastened death or planned death or some other phrase. However, we are regulators, we're highly legalistic, and that phrase tracks directly from C-14, which was the criminal code amendment, so we'll just use that. The Carter decision set out very nicely that the medical model, and I use the word medical rather loosely to really recognize the broad range of practitioners who fall within the medical world, that the concept of free and informed consent could be the basis under which people would access assistance in dying. And of course, the Carter decision talked about physician-assisted dying, and I'm very pleased that we've moved on to the more inclusive term medical assistance in dying to recognize that it is, in fact, a team of practitioners who work with patients. So what does that free and informed consent model really look like? It means that the patient has been given all of the relevant information that they need to make informed decisions about their health care. It means that they have also been given, because it's in the criminal code amendments, information about palliative care and other end-of-life options. So again, it's not either or. It's about a range of options that people have in front of them. We value autonomy in our society, and patients are allowed to make free and informed decisions. So they don't have to go to a panel and get approved, right? This is a decision between the practitioners and the patient. And our expectation of physicians is that they must have an adequate medical record that includes all of that information. So they need to be documenting the patient's diagnosis, prognosis, treatment options, that they've been given information about palliative care, that they really understand the values and beliefs of their patient, that this patient is making a decision free of any coercion or undue influence. And when I speak to groups of physicians, I really remind them that they have a duty to act in the best interest of the patient. And that may not be simply saying, sure, I will do that for you, right? It is, are you satisfying yourself as well that the patient isn't marginalized, isn't a victim in their current domestic relationship or a family relationship, that they are in fact able to make this decision, because capability is an important aspect of this, that they aren't being seen as a burden to the family, that they aren't otherwise vulnerable. And I see many of these roles as roles where you as a member of the healthcare team can be of assistance in those kind of discussions. There is an important role for everybody to document. And always somebody always puts their hand up in the crowd and says, could I be sued for this? And I say, yep. So even if the patient meets the criteria, you've done everything, everything's okay, it doesn't mean that the daughter-in-law from California isn't going to fly home at the last minute and be the fly in the ointment and all of this. So for practitioners, your best defense is a good, sound documentation and a record of what you've done. We do have provincial forms, and the use of those provincial forms, they're administrative, but they were designed to be at a glance collaboration for the healthcare team. So you've got this thing about two opinions and the pharmacist dispensing to the practitioner and all of that. But it was really meant to serve as at-a-glance collaboration and a checklist so that everybody's kind of made sure that all the moving parts and pieces are there. But they're not tied to any particular law in British Columbia. So the way we've made the provincial forms mandatory is they're simply in our practice standards. With time, we may see actual provincial law coming in on top of the federal law. But what we have are some amendments to how we do healthcare in British Columbia. So, for instance, for the practice of medicine, the Minister of Health made it a requirement in our regulations that we had to set standards for this type of practice. I believe the same was put in for the College of Registered Nurses. We have had the regulations for nurse practitioners amended, so they're actually allowed to prescribe the substances that are used in this, so they are now authorized through that process to be part of the provider aspect here. And we also have an amendment to the Coroner's Act that allows the coroner to then serve as the oversight and monitoring piece. And that was certainly an important aspect of the federal legislation, is this expectation that there shall be public reporting. And again, big social change, it's imperative that there be public reporting. One of the things the Minister of Health in British Columbia asked us to do when we were developing our practice standards was to be certain that the use of telemedicine could be incorporated in this process. And that was largely around the fact that we do have rural, remote areas of the province, and simply finding two practitioners who aren't actually conflicted might be problematic. We recognize and respect that there is conscientious objection for many providers, so there kind of need to be some workarounds around that. So we did bring in our practice standard, the ability for one, but not both, of the assessments to be conducted by telemedicine. But the caveat in that is we said there needed to be another regulated health professional in the room to be a witness to that consultation. And they're not there to be anything but impartial and independent to make sure that, again, that whole concept of coercion, arm twisting, whatever, that again, so they're kind of a witness to, if you like, that informed consent discussion. The provincial forms are actually now many. There's a requirement for the patient to use a provincial form when they want to request medical assistance in dying, and that needs to be signed by two independent people who aren't involved in their healthcare. Then there's an assessor form, and then what we call the prescriber form, because it's somebody's got to actually write the prescription. If there's any question about the patient's ability to consent or their capability, there's actually another form for assessment of that, if that's in question. There's a checklist. There's now also a coroner's reporting form, and that does need to be completed by whoever was the prescriber in this process. We do have a standard, or do have in our standard, an expectation that the prescriber stays with the patient until death is confirmed. And as you've alluded, most of the patients are being provided with intravenous routes to death. And that's largely because we don't have good oral medications. And this actually tracks back to the fact that in the United States, they have capital punishment, and the drug companies in Europe make the drugs, and they don't want to sell the drugs to be used for this purpose. So anyways, when I started practice, because I actually should have said I just graduated a long time ago, as opposed to actually saying it was many, many decades ago, Seconal was in use. And Seconal fell out of favor because patients accidentally overdosed on it all the time. So we have much safer drugs now to use for sedation and hypnosis, sleep aids, etc. So those drugs are not readily available. And so that's why the IV route is preferred. Because of the very high failure rate with the existing cocktails that exist for an oral route, and I think there have been some oral uses in British Columbia, what we didn't want is it to not be successful, and then the family is in angst, and how many hours go by when somebody's deeply comatose, and worse, somebody calls 911. I mean, that's really not the point of it. So the physician or nurse practitioner needs to stay until death is confirmed, just to make sure that it is a completed task. In British Columbia, we have taken a route to reconcile those who have conscientious objection against the autonomous rights of patients to make free and informed consent to access lawful medical services. And we have not required that the practitioner make a formal referral when their patient asks for this, when they're not prepared to be involved. And that is different than in Ontario, where the Ontario College has said you must make an effective referral, and they use the word referral. And we certainly heard from many individuals, and particularly the Christian Medical Dental Society, that the word refer was going to be very, very problematic. So we did some polling of registrants and tried to, again, look how we could reconcile that. And we've landed in a space where there is still an ethical and professional obligation on every physician in this province to give the patients enough information so that they actually know that it is lawfully available. So if a patient asks about it, you can't say it's not available. You can't misrepresent that. There is an expectation that if you don't want to be part of that, that you would share that with your patient, but also acknowledge that you, the physician, have an obligation to assist that patient in transferring their care somewhere else. We didn't use the word refer, we used the word transfer. And the good news is that every single health authority in the province has actually developed a MAID care coordinator. So there is sort of, if you like, that 1-800 number that people can actually call and navigate. We've been very clear with physicians they must not abandon care, and they're not allowed to badger their patient or try to impose their value system on. That's not being ethical and professional. So when I do speak to groups of physicians, I like to remind them that this is a highly vulnerable population for whom simply saying, well, and here's the 1-800 number, is probably not going to be enough. They may have mobility impairment. They may have visual impairments. They may not actually have access to a telephone or a computer. And their obligation is to figure out what assist is going to look like, because it's got to be meaningful. And my call to those who are conscientious objectors is that we would really like to reconcile that, but your ethical and professional obligations can't be barriers to accessing care. That otherwise the public interest and the patient interest would be that we would actually have to go to using the word refer, which we don't want to do. And for those of you who read the media, you know that a week doesn't go by that we don't have a bioethicist talking about how can you be part of the healthcare system and not be obliged to refer, and then the next ethicist saying, we don't want any part of this, and it is still of great debate amongst all of us. So at this point, I'm going to turn it over to Cynthia and have her talk about the registered nursing aspect.
So Heidi's actually covered off most of the issues that the nursing group has, which is important. I think one thing I'd like to highlight about this change, particularly in British Columbia, is the collaborative nature of the work between the College of Physicians and Surgeons, the College of Registered Nurses, and the College of Pharmacists, in addition to all of the health authorities, the Coroner's Office, the Ministry of Health. It's been an incredible journey for all of us to go through working on not only a provincial regulatory change, but the actual implementation. For the nursing group in particular, I think for our registrants, the issue really around conscientious objection has been the biggest hurdle for most of them. So when I talk to my staff about what are our practice calls around this matter, it's around conscientious objection and trying to nuance the work that nurses do in palliative care, which is a long history and a mental model that they experience, versus the patient choosing. And it's a very different kind of choice. So Heidi alluded to the fact that this is the biggest societal change, cultural change that she'll see in her lifetime. I agree. It's substantive, and I think it's reflective of the fact that we have moved to a patient-centered model of care. And in particular, I think in British Columbia, we had a very engaged Minister of Health on this issue. So, for example, nurse practitioners who can assess for medical assistance in dying in British Columbia, that's not the same in some of the other provinces. And that's due in part to the fact that regulations here in British Columbia actually turned over and happened quite quickly. And I actually went online last night to just see whether or not in the BC laws section, whether or not our regulations have been updated with the change. And they still haven't, but it is in effect. So, you know, it's interesting how important and imperative it was, and yet we're still waiting for that actual final regulation to be posted. But in terms of how CRNBC has managed this transition, one thing we did do is work very closely with Heidi and her team around developing standards that align for both nurse practitioners, registered nurses, pharmacists and physicians. And again, because this is such a huge societal shift, I think it's really important that we have aligned our standards and that the expectation we have of our practitioners around managing conscientious objection, the ethical dilemmas that they may experience, we are using the same language, the same messaging, and the same expectations on our websites, in our consultations, in our presentations to registrants across the province. The other thing I want to speak to is around both the College of Physicians and Surgeons and the College of Nurses have indicated that practitioners only do this when they are competent to do it. And one of the challenges has been whether or not you require formal education in order to provide medical assistance in dying. And Heidi often uses the term, see one, do one. Is that your term?
See one, do one, teach one.
Teach one, yeah. And that's actually pretty much what we've done. There isn't formal education in North America, I would think, for medical assistance in dying. We have had a number of practitioners, both nurse practitioners and medical practitioners, who've gone overseas to other countries to seek out more formalized educational opportunities in the way of conferences and continuing education. But in North America, there hasn't been a formal preparatory piece for this particular service. So it is really exactly that. See one, do one, teach one. So I'm going to just flip to the next. I know there are probably people have questions, but again, just to highlight the collaborative nature of this work. And it's, again, from the point of view of a regulator, it's been really important to have consistency in how we set the standards and how we message for our registrants about this change. And that also translates into good care for patients, because the expectation that a patient has of any practitioner involved in medical assistance in dying is now the same. So I think I might just pause there because I know there's probably a ton of things that Kevin still needs to say and then also opportunities for questions.
Thank you, Cynthia. This is all about me. And this is very, very important that this notion of collaboration is recognized, because what I've found not doing MAID but doing ethics around end-of-life care is that when there is a very good, well-resourced, multidisciplinary, interprofessional team, that least worst death can approach something fairly extraordinary. And what I think is one of the most important things that I didn't learn until my father died is that anybody who's had a very near person die to them, and I think it's most powerful when you're there the moment they die, you take that death legacy with you through the rest of your life. You take it to your own deathbed, basically. And given that my father was the only person in our family who's died so far that is central to my family's life experience in that kind of way, the fact that all seven children were around the bed when he died, the fact that it turned into a very funny situation just before he died, which is very much telling about our family, the fact that we still talk about that experience over and over and over again, it was the best thing it could probably be for a whole host of reasons that I can talk to you about later. But it's that idea that we can actually help create and shape these legacies for our clients and their families and friends. And that's what's really important about trying to bring the notion of the highest quality end-of-life care into practice. So the other thing just to say about interprofessional collaboration around MAID is that there's this Carter carve-out, and we know that medical and nurse practitioners are specifically identified. It also specifically identifies the pharmacist and requires that the pharmacist who's dispensing the medication knows what the medication is for, so they can not have to experience an unwanted surprise at some point. But what it also does is it says, for clarification, no social worker, psychologist, psychiatrist, therapist, medical practitioner, nurse practitioner, or other healthcare professional commits an offense if they provide information to a person on the lawful provision of medical assistance in dying. Which means you can talk about it, you can explain it, you can give people information, and you're not going to be held liable for some criminal offense that doesn't exist. And that's really important that you should know this. And what's interesting is we talked about all those safeguards and all those things that are pretty difficult to make sure you believe them to be true, like there's no undue influence. Nobody's pressuring this. sadly, what is more than likely going to happen is that most people will be pressured the other way not to ask for this because their families won't want it. But some people might be pressured towards it. But the law also recognizes that you could have a reasonable belief that the safeguards have been met based on the information the client's given you, based on the information other people have given you, and you might actually be wrong. But it says if you have a reasonable belief, even though you're wrong, you're still exempt from prosecution. But the documentation, of course, is what will demonstrate that your belief was reasonable. So it always has to be documented. And then the last thing that we've been talking about over and over again is the idea that the law says specifically nothing in this section compels an individual to provide or assist in providing medical assistance in dying. So that is your Charter of Rights and Freedoms conscientious objection opt-out, should you wish. What's important to note here, and we'll see how it pans out in time, it says there in the law, individual. And the debate often now is about whether organizations, institutions that are publicly funded can ask for an organizational opt-out. BC is just like the crucible of all these deep, deep questions. There's been some brewings around members of the board of Catholic hospitals resigning because they think it's wrong for the institution to opt out. That will remain to be seen what happens over time, and there's a kind of cordial cooperation going on at the moment. The trouble is where somebody feels that their charter right to request and be provided with this is interfered with by people who are objecting, institutions and even individuals sometimes. That's where it comes a cropper of the charter's limitation. So the charter says you have all these rights and freedoms until you don't. And none of them are guaranteed in abstract. There's always reasons for the sake of other individuals and public and society's well-being at large that those rights and freedoms can be limited. The other thing just to say is that conscientious objection is one part of it. What we're often doing now is referring to conscientious participation. Because hopefully this always brings some yuck, and hopefully it's always a little bit of a struggle with your conscience about, oh dear, is this the right thing for this person at this time? I can't necessarily know, but they're going to help me figure it out for them. You'll be participating very conscientiously. Everybody who does this, that I know at least, does it very conscientiously, even if it looks like they're doing it in a kind of laissez-faire way. So, that said, you can talk about this. The College of Social Support Workers and Social Workers in Ontario left a few of my colleagues feeling very uneasy when they published their interim guidance about this because it kind of left everybody just not knowing if they can talk about this because will it be considered counseling suicide, which is still a criminal offense because it has to be. Because sadly, there are people out there who will do things like what happened to the woman in Ottawa a few years ago, about 5-6 years ago, Nadia Kijuji, who was very depressed, was chatting in online chat rooms about her depression and was being advised by somebody that, probably, if you kill yourself, it's the best way out for everybody, for you, for your family, for your friends. And she waded into the Ottawa River in January or February during her first or second year at Carleton, which is well known, early university years for being highly stressful. Not necessarily Carleton, but everywhere. And so she was counseled to die by suicide. And that has to be an offense. And it remains an offense except where the MAID criteria are met and safeguards are met. So that's where you step in this position. So should you end up stepping in and helping some of your esteemed colleagues work around this with somebody, what might an OT offer? This is what OTs across the country said. We offered them just the things we could think of at first, and they ticked all these boxes. So biggest thing is tying up life roles, which makes beautiful sense. And then other things like helping make memories. Actually, I'm wrong. This is your responses, I believe. Things like helping people explore the alternatives. So if you can offer some way to make it a little bit more bearable for a little bit longer, somebody might live another week and get another week out of life, maybe even a month. Who knows? And then planning with the team, with the family, with the client. And capacity assessment is another thing that very often is done as a collaborative endeavor. And in this case, it's ultimately going to be the medical or nurse practitioners involved who will have to testify, basically verify that and document that this person's capable. But given that you see clients do things in different ways, in different contexts, in different kinds of activities, you can get a sense of the way they're talking about this. And if you feel that there's anything that you think they have misunderstood, and you can share that, and that's very good. In other end-of-life care situations, what might you do? Well, the list that you identified is pretty much the same. This is not applying things very differently in terms of practice skills. It's just recognizing that this is to a different goal of care that the client has identified. So it's still very much in keeping with what you would be expecting to do in end-of-life care. It's just a different goal that the client has decided is the best one for them. Some of the other things that you said about MAID, as much as I lament this association with the word suicide, I feel I end up needing to address it regularly, particularly having just been for 2 years working at the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, where suicide prevention is a massive thing. Trying to get people to understand that this is different to what we typically refer to as suicide, which is a crisis-driven, typically, response that is not supported particularly well by anybody in the moment. It's something very different. So I asked you if you thought it was different clinically, and you said yes, pretty much. The trouble with it is, most of us also know people who may have died by suicide, and there may be one or two people in those stories that we've encountered where we actually think it's perhaps this thing called rational suicide, that this person's life was, for decades, not actually getting much better despite endless attempts for improvement through treatments. And some people in mental health will talk about palliative psychiatry and the idea that you reach a point where everything is exhausted and we have nothing left to offer, and maybe the only way for the person to escape their symptoms is actually to end the symptoms altogether by ending their life. And some people will argue, and other people will dispute it, that that's possible. That's not on the table in our context, because the person has to have a naturally foreseeable death in the reasonable future. You also said things like, it's related to having informed options, the difference. Some people felt that it was just a matter of semantics, and it's the same thing, and assisted suicide, assisted death just sounds better. I have a clinical responsibility to prevent harm to self or others. MAID is a process rather than a decision, a reaction rather, which is the way that I would usually see it. Suicide is not a last resort after all other medical options fail us, which is what this person, I think, felt assisted dying is. And what will happen when we stop thinking about suicide as a cry for help and accept it as okay? And that's what we should never do. Every request for assisted dying needs to be explored as basically a statement that this isn't working for me the way we're doing it now. And what else can we do? And does this mean that some suicide is actually okay? And some people will argue that some suicide is probably okay. And I have a very thick book I'm trying to read at the moment called Rational Suicide, Irrational Laws. And it's fascinating reading. Is it morally different? I have no idea what this question was trying to ask. All I know is that I wanted to ask the question and get you just to think about what that means to you when you see those words. So none of these results are ready to be taken with anything more than oh, that's curious. What does that mean? What do I think about that? So not surprisingly, it's much smaller. But what's interesting is a lot of people said things like, I believe I feel tremendous sadness, but it's not wrong. So morally, even a suicide that's one of those crisis things, we tend not to think judgmentally, morally about it. It's no longer a criminal offense to die by your own hand or to attempt to, which it was until some decades ago. Sometimes life becomes too difficult to bear, so therefore people might do this. I do not judge that line for each individual where they decide it's not going to be enough for me anymore. And morally, we seem to see them as different in that typical suicide is a permanent solution to a temporary problem. Assisted death is a permanent solution to a permanent problem, which is a great line, I thought. So I did then ask about the conscientious objection thing. Would you feel like you would consider declaring it? And it split pretty evenly between yes, no, and I'm not sure yet, which is typical, I think, among a lot of professionals. And then do you feel you would need support if you did feel like you might have to make a conscientious objection in this? And vastly, people said yes, that they would want to be able to talk through it. And this is where the processes, the policies, are needing to be well thought through. And then we said, what do you want from the college that might help? So things like guidelines and standards and position statements, please tell us what's right and what's wrong. So the expectations the college may have, the OT role, supportive resources for conscientious participation and objection to help initiate and foster conversations around this. So it's about making this happen in a really just way, in a safe way, and in an open way so that nobody has to feel bad about it. And then continuing education resources, like a handbook or an online module about the legal things, the criteria, the roles, clarify that I need a really good place to go and double check it quite quickly, which I do too. Resources that would be helpful to the client as well as to the OT. So a lot of places have produced FAQ documents. There's a really neat little brochure that Island Health has got. Just explain it in brief detail. And then support documentation around both participation and objection so that you can make sure it's easily documented. And then what else might you need from COTBC? Resources to support the conversations, ongoing education, and a written overview of what should be considered in these contexts. Please also, college people, advocate for the OT to have a role in end-of-life care. It's in the client's best interests to engage in meaningful occupation at end-of-life in terms of quality of life, but there isn't funding for that, unfortunately, in a lot of places. Advocate to have OT part of the interdisciplinary team that advises clients who are considering MAID. Education on clinical approaches and resources, and a forum or a focus group, maybe like this one, for OTs to debrief and further discuss these issues. So I think those kind of fora could happen through the college itself, or it could happen through more local contexts, which would be quite good. What I'll just say is that we'll shift to the panel now, but I'll also say that if anybody wants at any point in time, you can feel free to email me. There are so many really useful resources out there that are audio resources, visual resources. I can make my slides available to you. I'll just take out the ones that might be copyrighted or something, like pictures that aren't mine. But the information is all just up there. And I can email it to you. And my email address is very easy, and I got my cards. So it's just utoronto.ca/kevin.real, which we'll give you later. But we'll go back to the questions.
All right, so it is time to open up the floor for questions. I want to thank you guys very much. We have about 20 to 30 minutes or so for questions, and I'm hoping there's some good ones out there that you guys have saved. We have the lovely Cindy, our deputy registrar, who has a mic over there, as well as Mary Clark, who's the director of communications in the Quality Assurance Program. So that we can hear your good question, I'm going to ask that you put up your hand and somebody will come to you and give you the mic. And if you can say your question right into the mic, that way your question gets recorded for all of our colleagues who couldn't make it today and they want to listen to it later on the website. So we will go ahead and get started. And we have about 20 to 30 minutes. Raise up your hand nice and high.
Hi. I was really interested to read the for your clarification where it says that you may speak to people about this and give them information. At an information in service that I was at in my health authority, we were told quite clearly that we weren't allowed to speak to people and give them information and that we had to direct them to our physician coordinator. So that would be one of those things that I would like to have some support and clarification written from the college about to support us to be able to have conversations with people. And I'm wondering, I guess my question is, why would we have a direction like that? Or maybe we were in process still of not being able to speak about it.
I'm wondering if it's that difficult conversation of you kind of need to have the patient raise it first. That's the issue. Otherwise, you run the risk, I think, of looking like you're aiding and abetting. So that may be what the discomfort was. I suspect, I mean, this is new, really new. And as much as we've got to be all on the same page and have this sort of marvelous collaboration, it started in May, right? So I think that as we have more experience, comfort, certainty, like what have we learned, what went wrong, we have to have that reflective piece. And because all of the oversight and monitoring isn't owned by the health authority, it's really owned by the coroner's office, and they haven't done that yet. We've been told it should probably happen before the end of this calendar year, but that's probably what it's about, because I think that we all feel a bit more certain that you're kind of on the right track when the patient has clearly said, well, what about this? Then that it's a different conversation. But I can't speak for OT, but that's sort of my sort of wearing a regulator hat kind of thing.
Just on the point of it being so new, had several conversations about it's a lot easier to move forward slowly than it is to go ahead fast and then draw back. So I think in particular for the regulators, it's even just getting the feedback on volume, how often, what practitioners are involved. Is it becoming a bit of more of a, not a specialty practice, but there are a few known practitioners in a health authority who are managing those requests. And so that we don't know if that's what it's going to look like in the future. So I do think health authorities are being thoughtful about not putting pressure on their staff to go to this extreme, potentially, without some clarity and some clear understanding what the process is going to look like at that employer level. So I'm not surprised to hear that, and I think it will change over time.
I have a critical care colleague in Toronto who understands the yuck factor and the hesitation to raise this as a potential among the goals of care, but then turns it around and says, how are we actually assuring ourselves that our clients are giving informed consent about what we do plan to do if this has never been raised? And it's a kind of curious thing because you sort of think, who in Canada doesn't know about this right now? But it's a little dance that people do, and that is something that they'll learn to do better over time. The other thing that what we've done in our ethics discussion document and what we're doing in a lot of the policies that I know my colleagues are writing now is distinguishing between what we call informal inquiries and formal requests. And it's unfortunately the case that we can't easily track the informal inquiries, which is where a lot of where I work now, the care coordinators and even the personal support workers have to respond to informal inquiries. It's when it becomes a formal request that the paperwork starts trailing in, then it becomes something that's easily documented and we can track it over time. So, yeah.
Just in terms of the college piece, I think we don't have a position yet. I think we don't know what that looks like. So today is about getting information, understanding from our BC Health Regulator colleagues that are in the middle of this in terms of trying to set those standards and figure out what it's about. We have the luxury, I think, when I look across the country, of having a very integrated and good BC Health Regulators collaborative, which means I don't see why we would be developing our own statements aside from those other team members that would be potentially involved with the kinds of clients that we know occupational therapists deal with all the time that are at the spectrum where they might be thinking about. And the flip side of that coin is what occupational therapists can do to support the quality of life and being informed about what some of those other options are, not just about dying. So I would see us trying to figure this out with our other colleagues and certainly working closely with those that have the most responsibility in the area. In terms of employers, I think I agree with Cynthia that they're trying to manage this because the public, it is like May till now, that's rocket speed. And for a societal change, that's pretty massive. So I see us, this is the sort of a first step of figuring out what that looks like and trying to start with education and information and being quite clear about what those roles would be and what that looks like when you're in the middle of it. We have been getting practice questions already. There was one yesterday at our board meeting about, am I allowed to go help for that 10 days because I've been sent in to do something with walkers and safety supports, and am I allowed to know that they've asked for, that this is the 10-day comfort period? So this stuff is happening, and I see us making sure we do collaborate and work with both you and health authorities and certainly our fellow regulator colleagues about how this looks to help provide the best advice we can.
I'd like to thank you very much for this presentation. It was really good, and I'm really glad we had that spectrum of ethics as well as registration and college and ideas around representing legislative development. My observation is that the legislation has finally caught up with what a lot of practice was already doing, legally or not legally, but I would regard it as compassionate care. But I have to say there's one thing that really concerns me about the legislation, and that is related to, it feels like the people that wrote all live in cities where there's lots of people around and there are lots of different healthcare practitioners around, but there are many communities in Ontario and British Columbia and across our country where they're lucky to have one nurse or they're lucky to have one physician there, or it's a physician and a nurse and one of the pair is dying. And the ability to have the second person available is very, very difficult. Even in the event of being able to do it remotely, you still need a second person available. And I think we need to reflect on some of those rules and some of these legislations in the real situations that people are in.
Yeah, in much the same way that it's really hard to get hemodialysis in name your small community, right? There are those really real access issues. Having said that, I can say that there are a cohort of practitioners, nurse practitioners and physicians, who are quite prepared to fly around the province. Having the care coordinator housed in each health authority, and as we have more people who are trained and competent and can do all of that, I think that some of the workarounds and some of the rural access issues are being addressed. I think the numbers have been more than people anticipated. So, you know, I look sort of for Alberta Health Services. Whatever resources they've had, they've had to double it. And that's not just for the provision of MAID, but it's also all the, like, because remember, there are a whole bunch of people are going to want to talk about it. They may actually even sign the paperwork and then change their mind. But that doesn't mean you don't do all of that work behind the scenes. So I think we may have underappreciated that autonomy that patients expect to be able to have this in that choice. We do need to look at resources. It needs to be in the context of good end-of-life care more broadly. But as regulators, we're obviously not in the access business, nor are we in the sort of supply and demand business. But from a regulatory point of view, we've tried to be flexible enough to, within the confines of good care, make things like telehealth support this. So
the other thing to say is that the way that we've actually been framing it anyways in our discussions in Toronto and around Ontario is that we need to try to make access equitable. And one of my co-authors on that discussion paper is a physician who is both an eMERGE physician and a family physician, and also somebody who flies into rural and remote communities 4 or 5 times a year and is effectively the family physician to 4 or 5 small communities in northern Ontario. So she was brilliant at being acutely aware. There's also the difference when this is happening in the community, in people's homes, and then long-term care homes, and how that is made equitable or not. So we recognize that it's there. But the other thing that we recognize is that whilst it's important to do it as soon as possible because of the reason being it's about suffering, it's not an emergent procedure. And nobody sees this as something that requires an emergency response. There are other things for that. That said, we don't want it to be as protracted as it might be if it's not easily done. And that's why the telehealth option helps things do a little bit better. But even in Toronto, I got a phone call yesterday from work. A family who's trying to sort somebody to sign the request on behalf of their family member who can't do it themselves, who's independent. 2 witnesses to witness the signing by the signer, and then a separate assessment from another healthcare professional who's qualified to do the assessment of eligibility. And it sounds like it's not that much, except when you've got somebody who's in a lot of pain in front of you, and you're trying to do this without having to tell the entire circle of friends what's going on right away, in the hope that one of them will say, okay, I'll witness, and one of them will say, okay, I'll sign. And so it's actually bizarrely more complex than I thought it was in some cases. In others, it's been perfectly fine.
Right. Thank you. I had a practical question, you guys, about, so we talk a lot about resources and education for clients and for caregivers. Right now, I know there might not be the best available, but I'd like to be able to provide something to clients and family that has no jargon, that's like layman's terms, easily accessible for, you know, grade 5 reading level. Is there anything out there right now that explains this sort of stuff, or are we still working on it? I'm just curious, because I think that would be really helpful for a lot of populations, especially culturally sensitive too. So like we get lots of different cultures, especially in Vancouver, right? I work with a lot of Chinese and Indian populations and just everything, like the whole gamut. So I was curious, as of right now, what would be the best resource to direct families to so they can start to understand the complexity of it all, right? Because it's not an easy issue for people to wrap their heads around, and they're obviously very emotional, right? Friends and family are. I would say when I've worked in acute care and in long-term care that the families are almost more affected than the clients themselves, right? That it's really hard on them and all that grief. Yeah. So if we can give them really clear, concise, easy-to-read stuff, that would be awesome. Thank you.
We don't have anything.
Nope.
But the health authorities might, and I know for Vancouver Coastal Health Authority, there's a MAID care coordinator, and that's who I'd contact. I know that there's a web address and an intranet MAID care coordinator.
All of the health authorities have one, or the regional health authorities. And I think, again, it's the whole newness of this. It wasn't like the perfect launch would have been, you know, branding exercise, brochures translated into 40 languages, all that stuff. I think that will come with time. And also I think just the depth of understanding within the public sphere about what this actually means. It's a culture shift. I mean that broadly in the context of Canada.
There are some emerging good resources, I would say. And I have to confess that the trouble is that you're always going to probably be the best resource for the family that you're working with. So get your own sense of what this is about clarified and chatted through with other people so that you know how to talk about it quite clearly. But there are some good leaflets out there. This is the Island Health Authority has a very good little leaflet on it. In fact, the Government of Canada's website has a very relatively accessible document about it that just goes through everything that's there. If you go to the Joint Centre for Bioethics at the University of Toronto, there is an FAQ document there for clients and families that we've been updating prior to the legislation being changed and whatnot. It's being beta tested with patients and families as well, so it might evolve and become plainer. So there's stuff out there. It hasn't yet been kind of refined to be particularly culturally sensitive, I don't think, anywhere, because that will become something that I think individual members of various particular cultures and microcultures might have to do. So, yeah.
My voice booklet. It starts the conversation of values, personal values, what's important to you at the end of life.
So that's the Ministry of Health
My
booklet called
Voice.
My Voice.
And you can Google it, and it's in doctor's offices, yeah. It's in libraries, and it starts the conversation.
And there's that's also, awesome. To the same end, again, not just about MAID, but about end of life in general, the entire set of resources available through Speak Up, the advancedcareplanning.ca website. April 16th, every year, is a National Advanced Care Planning Day. I'd like to challenge OTs to all do their own advanced care plans before they try to do it with a client. Yeah, that's out there as well, which is, I think, in the same vein as that. And it doesn't just focus on, it doesn't talk about MAID, but it talks about goals of care.
Just a quick question. I had heard some discussion on CBC just around, or my own thoughts, how do we actually measure a reasonably foreseeable death? And it was in the context of someone who's been mentally ill for many years and the difference between physical disabilities with maybe something like ALS and how it takes away your independence and quality of life versus someone who has particularly been mentally ill for many years, has tried everything, but still has a wish or a need in terms of end of life.
There are sort of three broad areas within the current legislative framework where medical assistance in dying, they're not eligible, and the sole indication being a mental illness is not. The other one are pediatric patients, and then the other one is advanced directives. So there was one court-authorized medical assistance in dying that occurred in Alberta during that time from February to June, which had as a sole indication a persistent serious psychiatric disorder. But the federal legislation makes it quite clear that that is off the table. And what they have promised is something to study and bring back in 3 years' time. So just bias. You know, prior to joining the college, my family practice involved a lot of looking after people's serious, persistent mental illness. And you're right, we always judge how ill they are by what their suicidal ideation is. So it's going to be a tough one for somebody to grapple with. I suspect this is going to be litigated in the courts. There's going to be court challenges, and that's why we have people who've been elected or people who get to be judges make really tough decisions. Good news, we don't have to make them.
You can be mentally ill and still be capable, but it's quite interesting.
Yeah, and that's where the major yuck factor lies for a lot of psychiatrists with whom I've been working for years at CAMH, that I think for the first time now, the assessment of capacity in that context, if it were legal for somebody who has solely a mental health related life that they're calling intolerable because of the psychological suffering, if I, as your psychiatrist and then as a second assessor, find you capable to make this decision, it feels like a very direct line to your death, which is a very different thing to the most analogous thing, which is that I might find you capable enough to be released from hospital when you've been brought in after an attempt at suicide. And if you go out afterwards and you then either attempt again or complete it the next time, it's not quite the same direct line from my assessment of capacity, which is it feels profoundly distressing. And it's also just, it's a totally different mindset in psychiatry where this idea that the recovery approach, that everybody can find a way to live with their mental illness if we just keep trying to do the right thing and combine things. That's kind of got everybody happily embracing hope endlessly. But there are some stories of people who say it's just not enough, sorry.
Thank you again for opening this important conversation. My question relates back to culture, which we were just touching on, and I'm wondering if any of you folks or anyone else in the crowd has heard if there has been consultation or conversation among different cultural groups, and particularly our Indigenous peoples, and if there's been any place for our Indigenous persons to say what matters to them and how their cultural perspectives play into MAID and this legislation.
First Nations Health Authority has been engaged as a health authority in the conversation here in British Columbia. And I think for most of the colleges, I don't want to speak for everyone because they're not all here, cultural safety and cultural competency is a foundation in terms of our expectation of a professional. Certainly within the nursing curricula, we expect that it is foundational. I think medicine as well. Yes. So in terms of the actual impact for society, I think that's a conversation all British Columbians need to have. But in the context of care being provided, first, FNHA has been privy to all of the work that we've done so far. I don't know, Heidi, have they been any different as a health authority? No, it's pretty even, Stephen. The cultural implications are broad, of course, and that's why it's patient-centered care, because we need to be thoughtful and respectful of cultural needs of the client, so, or patient.
Good morning. I have more of a comment rather than a question. I'm an occupational therapist and a lawyer, and I'm part of a committee for the Trial Lawyers Association of British Columbia. Our upcoming medical legal conference in January of 2017 actually centers around this issue. And I don't know if it's reassuring or not, but it's a big issue within the legal community and within the medical community, and we haven't sorted it out. So if you're here and you're feeling very unsure, just know that we're all unsure as well. Chief Justice Hinkson is going to be speaking at our medical legal conference, as well as there will be numerous presentations by physicians and lawyers with respect to those same questions about the line of what is imminent death. And I suspect, as has been mentioned by the panel, that this will be an issue that's going to continue to be litigated and clarified over these upcoming years. I just think the most important thing as OTs is that we stay attuned to kind of where that process is going, and it will eventually get clearer, and it's just great to hear that conversation is beginning to happen now. So thank you.
Thank you for raising this conversation, and thank you to COTBC for hosting you and asking you to be here. I continue to be appalled by the Margot Bentley case in the Fraser Valley because it seems like they don't understand reflexes. And secondly, it's an issue of justice and fairness. And so my question is, to what extent, and this is for anybody on the panel, you want to comment on it, to what extent do you think religious values are impeding access to MAID? Kevin, earlier you alluded to the fact that in Canada we have this idea of publicly funded religious institutions, which I think is an oxymoron. So if you could, any of you could speak to that.
This gets back to reconciling individuals' right, for want of a better word, to conscientiously object, but understanding that patient autonomy and lawful healthcare services kind of are on that other side. And, you know, somebody who practiced medicine for a couple of decades, and I worked at a Catholic hospital, I worked at a couple of non-Catholic hospitals, and, yeah, we kind of made it work. I mean, you just knew that patients weren't going to get tubal ligations there, they were going to get them there, right? And we just, it worked. And people kind of, like, the health, it works around the health system, right? That it does, and certainly our own Minister of Health has said, why would we expect St. Paul's Hospital to provide this service? Mm-hmm. Well, no, but again, just reconciling that. But the quid pro quo is, then it can't be a barrier to accessing care. Mm-hmm. And if it starts to look like it's being used as a barrier, or people are blocking, or people are, you know, being mischievous about this, or not being mindful of that ethical and professional obligation to recognize and respect patient-centered care, client-centered care, autonomy, justice, all of those other bits that are that ethical framework, then I think you'll see the healthcare system moving to do those kind of things that people are already a bit of a bellwether about, which is, so then if the institutions aren't getting it right, then the institutions may find themselves that option is off the table. Mm-hmm. And for individual practitioners, there may then be a public interest that requires referral, those kind of things. So I try to be careful that we are trying to reconcile and make it work. Time will tell if that's going to be the way that it is, but it is, I'm always grounded in what's in the patient's interest, what's in the public interest. And as I said, the fact that my patients couldn't get their tubal ligations at a particular hospital didn't affect their care.
My reflection is it's a question for our politicians. It's a question for all of us as society. So when you think about the number of significant changes in terms of healthcare delivery, abortion is another issue that remains still, I don't want to use the word divided, but you know, in terms of religious facilities offering or not offering services to clients around specific procedures. I think what drives that kind of change is societal's expectations. And we can, as regulators, certainly respond to that, because as it is, as Heidi said, our job is to protect the public interest. And so as the public interest or their interests shift, their focus shift, then we respond to that.
I am addicted to the news in parts because I always have to get up in the morning and decide if I can wear, you know, stripes or checkers or not, because whether or not I'm going to be on... or somebody's calling for my resignation. You know, you had one branch of the Catholic infrastructure saying, you will not attend for last rites, you will not offer. And then within 24 hours, another bit saying, well, we're doing it a little differently. So, you know, I think that everybody has their own bellwether, where they're going to focus. And I just think that, I guess I'm always optimistic, and we can make it work. And if we all bring the patient's best interest to the table, we can make it work.
I think I've got a quick question around clients with dual diagnosis that have a concurrent severe physical disability and have a secondary diagnosis of a mental health issue as a result of their disability. So one example that comes to mind is somebody that's a high quad that has exhausted their options and have worked for numerous years to have care in place. And we've explored all of those options for care. But then, despite having those options for care over several years, they've got an ongoing mood issue related to their condition. And with that comment earlier around mental health diagnosis is excluded in the legislation, how does that fit? Because sometimes that mental health diagnosis is secondary to the physical condition. And how does that get dealt with in the face of this legislation?
I'll start on this, and you can correct me when I'm wrong or what I miss as well. But part of it comes back to what I refer to as which twisted ticket you got in the perverse lottery. So if your spinal injury is high enough that you can't breathe independently, you can just withdraw your life-sustaining treatment, and it's done. And hopefully it's done in a very wonderful way with sedation, so you don't get air hunger and panic attacks and that sort of thing as you struggle with your last breaths. If your spinal injury is not that high, then you're not eligible anyways. So the fact that you're living with a mood problem constantly that makes your life intolerable above and beyond the fact that life's harder in many ways because you've got a high-level spinal injury, you're just not eligible under the law as it is. And there is a wonderful, incredibly heart-wrenching story of a bioethicist in Salt Lake City, Utah, named Margaret Pabst Batten, who wrote about assisted dying for decades. And then I think in 2007, her husband had a very high-level spinal injury. And suddenly she was living this kind of terrible tragedy day in, day out. And it's been written up in the New York Times, the magazine, and she's written about it again. If anybody wants to read more about it, I can send you the links and the documents. But she reflects a lot on this, and her husband talks about wanting to die for repeatedly, but never gets there until finally, after I think 4 or 5 years, he suddenly gets there. But he can just withdraw because he's got a C2-3 injury. And so it's not a matter of assisted dying anyways. But yeah, that's it's very... The other things that get very complex in mental health are both conversion disorder, where the person has such profound physical ailments that they may actually end up in a position where their life is threatened because they've stopped eating or something like that. And also, of course, anorexia, where there are many legal precedents in various countries where somebody with anorexia, the team has decided to stop treating after many years of trying to treat and seen the person as somebody who's got a terminal illness. And whether we would say at some point somebody like that could qualify as a natural death in the reasonably foreseeable future. So,
I just want to add one thing. What Naz was just articulating, this scenario, is exactly the case scenario that we're exploring within the Trial Lawyers Conference. That's exactly the kind of individual, the kind of patient that personal injury lawyers and the medical team and OTs often end up encountering. So it's really quite relevant that you bring up that type of client.
And what a number of people have commented on is it's not clear that Kay Carter, the eponymous Kay Carter of the Carter decision, she wouldn't necessarily qualify under this law because she didn't have a terminal diagnosis. Her natural death was foreseeable more because she was quite old and frail, but not because of spinal stenosis.
I have a similar question related to mental health realm. Just wondering if there's been conversations around mental health certificates and capability assessment. And I guess my question is a little bit reversal, where you have a client that is certified under the Mental Health Act in BC, develops a possible illness with a foreseeable death. Would the process be similar, or due to the kind of the criteria, would it be a different or more kind of onerous process for them?
A scenario might be somebody who's detained in an institution under the Mental Health Act, so extended leave provisions, who then goes on to develop a horrible end-stage esophageal carcinoma. What are their choices? You get the lawyers involved.
But the thing to remember there is that, at least I know the way that we've been talking about it under the Ontario law, is that you're looking at an assessment of capacity that isn't about global incapacity necessarily. It's about treatment-specific and decision-specific capacity. So we spent a lot of time trying to imagine whether it's possible that somebody could be incapable for a host of treatment decisions because they don't apparently understand and appreciate everything to do with it. But on this one, they might. And that's a really scary thing to try to have to tease out because, as I said, that capacity assessment could be the kind of direct line. Next week, I'm with a colleague presenting a seminar at the Joint Center for Bioethics where it's kind of similar. It's somebody who the client's story, which is based on stories we've experienced, is somebody who has had long-standing depressive illness and bipolar borderline personality disorder and attempts a suicide herself, and it's incomplete. Unsuccessful and ends up in ICU on life support and physically very damaged by this and probably cognitively damaged. And the question is, do you follow the substitute decision maker's request to not proceed with life-saving interventions? Or if you do that, are you basically at risk of feeling like you're completing somebody's suicide for them? Because the person's not capable because they're unconscious.
And I believe this will be the last question we're able to take this morning. Thank you.
Thank you. I wonder if there is any information or insight about, from insurance perspective. I work in home health, and I have had clients asking me when they have a young family and they have terminal illness, that if they pursue this way, would it affect their life insurance? Because mostly, if natural death is the option, then there is insurance coverage. But in this case, would it be considered otherwise?
Call your lawyer. But again, what I would say is, and this is not legal advice because I ain't no lawyer, but it's what I've heard lawyers say, which is that this discussion was had at length in the drafting of the legislation and the idea of this whole thing becoming decriminalized. And effectively, at the moment anyways, because natural death is reasonably foreseeable, there's a kind of apparently an understanding with insurance companies that this is going to happen anyways, and this is about mercy, and that there should not be any effect. But that said, many people have various ways of describing insurance companies that might suggest a different approach. So I have no interest in any insurance company.
Wow, what great questions you guys all had, and I'm sure there might even be some more. So if you do have some questions, Kathy, we'll be coming up here in a moment, but make sure you mark those questions down if you have any outstanding questions. So it's now time to move on to the final section of today's pre-AGM session. I'd like to introduce Kathy Corbett, probably a familiar face to most of you, the Registrar and CEO of COTBC. Kathy will lead a discussion and kind of revisit anything else that you might think you need from COTBC and go from there. So welcome, Kathy.
I am conscious of the time, so my job that I was tasked with, aside from thanking my friends here up on the panel, are there any sort of burning thoughts that you have in terms of leaving the college with your expectations and impressions of what you'd like us to do? We could have a couple of those comments, but I'll also direct you to the evaluation forms on the table. We do look at that feedback and consider it closely with future planning. So that's a good place for us to get some of your information. Are there any burning thoughts about from what you've heard today that you want to provide at least your thoughts about how the college should be approaching this before I would do some closing remarks?
I was debating whether I should say it or not, but I'm still not comfortable with the conversation that during the counseling, the medical team counseling the patient who is considering assisted suicide, especially regarding severe disabilities or the progression of the disease. When we are talking about quality of life especially, I think we can bring to the table a value perspective of what that disease may look like as far as the impact on function. And I think this is where OT, I think, can play a big role by counseling the patient. This is the practicality of life for you if you choose to continue. This is what we can help you with. Is this a life that you could bear? And I think, with all due respect to the medical team, but I'm not sure if they would know the details of what life is going to look like with a certain disability, with a certain progression of a certain disease. And I think we can bring a lot of value by explaining the practicality and the details of life, and that's informed consent. For them, we can have the best guess, based on our training, of what that look like and let them make that decision versus, because I think a lot of it is fear of, oh my God, I don't want to be disabled, I don't want people to take care of me, et cetera, and et cetera. But I think if we can be more objective about what life could look like and let them make that decision, I think this is a new field that we could contribute to uniquely. But I think we need to be at early on stages of that conversation rather at middle or towards the end of it.
I'm delighted to hear your comments about collaboration and to see the collaboration happening between the regulators. I think there's also opportunity here for collaboration around the regulators' role, around the professional association's role, around the role of the educators, around the role of health authorities. So there's room to collaborate, I think, across all the aspects of organizations that support the profession, and perhaps this is a place for Occupational Therapy Canada to provide forum for some of these discussions to happen.
Thank you. Maybe I'll ask the panel members to just make a comment or two, because I think what's important for me when I get my head around this is that this isn't the first conversation that's happening when the clients or patients or residents or family members you're dealing with. This isn't about at the very beginning, or if it is, then that's the conversation that needs to engage the team. And I think what I heard Cynthia, Kevin, and Heidi talk about are about what that team piece looks like. What is the collaborative information that helps that family become informed? And while OTB is not the primary person that's doing that initial conversation, the contributions of other team members to what that looks like. So I think it's kind of beginning with the learning part about what this is. And this isn't the first conversation you have when someone has their injury. It may be, but you get the right folks involved. So I think it's kind of where on that continuum this conversation happens and what the responsibility and information that if I'm thinking of Heidi's remark about the physicians ought to know more than just what they're doing, but what other things are possible to help that person be informed about that level of decision. So I'm not sure that triggers any other conversation, Cynthia or Heidi. So I appreciate it. I think that it speaks to those values and being clear that it's a difficult topic. And just in terms of closing, today is about kind of that opportunity to hear from experts, people that are living and breathing it. I hope if you go away with any message, we as a college always seek out expertise and resources. I have great respect and I'm honored to have two fantastic colleagues to work with the BC Health regulators, because there's experience and the collaborative energy that exists around our BC Health regulator colleges, so all the other health profession colleges, is quite strong, and I think we should be tackling some of these conversations together. So that the collaboration you heard about how the alignment with the College of Pharmacists, College of Physicians, and College of Registered Nurses around how they're setting the information and communication with health authorities and their practitioners they regulate. Similarly, the other regulatory colleges, we should have similar messaging around how we deal with those questions when they come up. We certainly know as a college occupational therapist, in many contexts, are going to be likely on the front lines of hearing some of this conversation. And the first step is getting to know it, lifelong learning around this particular topic of having good information. So misinformation isn't out there, and myth-busting is kind of part of that role. And seeking to have those conversations collaboratively with your colleagues. And we're in the rural, remote areas. How do we, in turn, set up those connections and networks that I think we've heard about today? So it's my absolute pleasure to thank Cynthia Johansson, Dr. Heidi Otter, and Kevin Reel for participating today.
Thank you very much.